Today's program has been brought to you by TechServe, New York's original and still the best Apple computer, iPod, and iPhone store and repair shop. For more information, visit TechServe.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org for thousands more.
We talk about food. We talk about music with musical dudes. Finger on the pulse, snacky tunes.
Coming in with a bullet?
Yeah, coming in with a bullet. Ending on a bullet.
Welcome to the 150th episode of
Snacky Dunes.
Is that what it's called?
It's studio audience.
This is going to be just an hour of bloopers, call-ins, thanks for the memories.
Yeah, we got our top five 36-second interviews. We're really excited to...
We've been working on this show since we started the first one.
Wow.
If you really think about it. The only work we're doing today is decimating pizzas, which we've... With the help
of really quick work.
Scott and Justin from Turing Machine, we've put down almost three full pizzas in 6 minutes? 6 minutes.
Sure. The last one, I think, is my favorite.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's got those slices of green peppers that remind me of pizza from growing up.
Yes.
So welcome.
Thank you for having us.
Justin, second time?
Second time.
Scott, first time?
First time.
First time guest, no time listener?
No, I listened to... I think I listened to Justin's show. So, okay.
It is known as my show.
Yeah.
And can we send a big shout out to Mama Bresnitz? And Papa Resnitz, happy anniversary yesterday.
Oh, yeah, happy
Mom,
anniversary.
Yeah.
34 years.
34 years. Whoa. But Mom, who's in the kitchen right now cooking Passover dinner, which we are going to hop in the car after this and drive to Philly.
Sweet.
And eat gefilte fish. So how long have you two known each other?
1991, so 22 years, I guess.
Jesus.
Wow.
Right.
Yeah, it's kind of nuts.
And why don't you run through the projects you've worked together? Can we talk about how they met? We'll get there.
We've been in two bands together, like two real bands that have made records. First band was in D.C. called Pitch Blend. That's Pitch Blend, one word with an E at the end. And
I didn't realize it was that always spelling.
Basically, yeah, every time you tell someone what band you're in, you'd have to add that to it. Yeah. And then we moved to New York kind of within a few months of each other. Yeah, and
I moved in December 94, and you moved, what, January, February,
March,
95?
March 95.
March 95.
And then late 90s, we started a band called Turing Machine, which is always kind of meant to be more of a project than a full-time band, and put up three records in Turing Machine and three records in Pitch Blend.
And currently you guys do what now?
I was a wine buyer at a retail shop for about 8 years, and now I'm a partner in a wine importing company with my friend Zev Rovine and my friend Laurent Bonbois. And we sell wine to retail and restaurants in New York City and to other distributors in America.
Is it? I heard it's a law that you need to have some guy named Laurent if you're going to do a wine business in the States.
We got a good Laurent, too, yeah. So we kind of lucked out.
A nice vintage one?
Yeah.
He's handsome. Smart, speaks great English.
And he's from the Laurent region, right?
Yes, he's from the Laurent. He lives right next to the Laurent River.
Nice.
And yeah. Scott?
I came to New York and kind of stumbled into a magazine career, writing, editing, and now I am at Bon Appetit magazine, a special projects editor, just kind of a title we kind of made up. But
those are the best kinds.
Give an example of a special project.
Well, we have an iPad edition, and I'm the editorial overseer of that. And then what else? Special project. Website.
An official bearer of salsa.
Oh, yes. I brought a couple things off the free table. A can of salsa. Oh,
thank you.
You keep iterating that it's free. Like, you want to...
I got it.
Like,
we got it. You didn't spend a dime on us.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank
really
you.
Good, guys. We couldn't have told you episode 150 enough to hint at, like, gifts, champagne,
I took
prizes.
A couple things off the expensive table.
Oh, there it is. Thank you. I feel so good. So
take it out of his paycheck.
Okay. So let's go back to the beginning. Okay. How did young whippersnapper Justin and young scuttlebutt Scott meet?
91.
I was playing, sort of making recordings with my friend who I worked in a record store with. And
hold on, 91, DC, working in a record store?
I know, hard to believe.
How much black or plaid were you wearing at the time?
I think I was wearing a fair amount of grunge chic, which is looking out at the crowd at Roberta's, pretty much the same gear.
It's a 20-year cycle.
Exactly, it's true. But, we put back then, you know, no internet, no nothing like that. So we put an ad in the newspaper before, like in the free alt weekly, before the back pages were just, you know, ads for prostitutes.
No,
there would actually be ads.
Before it got good.
Yeah.
Before it got real good.
So, and Scott and another guy answered, and we ended up, you know, it actually worked. Like we got together and jammed, and the first time we played, I think we wrote like three or four of the songs that were on our first record.
Who's the other guy?
There's a guy named Pat Goff that was a drummer, and the guy I was playing with is named Triops Trafid.
And what are Pat and Triops doing?
Triops is a visual artist in L.A., and I don't know. What's Pat do?
Pat works for a transportation think tank in D.C. and plays in a band called Imperial China.
That's true.
So you guys all have all, you know, you're not dead.
No.
No.
Yeah.
We're closer to it, but
yeah.
we are not.
Yeah, yeah. So you guys survived. And so what? So take us through Pitch Plan. What happened?
I mean, you know, it was such a fun time. It was the indie rock time. I mean, there was right around the time everybody figured out that you could put out your own music. So lots of people, there were just tons of bands, tons of records. People were very excited. You know, there wasn't a huge commercial. The independent scene wasn't really commercial. So at that time, if we wanted to go on tour in October, we'd start calling people in August, right. maybe even September, and book like a 2 or 3 week tour and go.
Did
and
you just have like a notebook of just like guys? Yeah.
And then we got a booking agent later. But when it started,
you I
just
think
pop a 7-inch in the mail and somebody call you back.
And you would at that time, Maximum Rock and Roll had the book your own. Am I allowed to swear on this?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Book your own fucking life.
And that actually, I think the second tour we may have used that, but the first one I remember just Justin calling people from his work phone.
Yeah,
at Olsen's Booking Records, and we told the story the other day, but he called me and said, "Hey, I got us a show in Denver." And it's like, "That's great. How much?" He said, "I'm not sure." He said a scene up. That's 100, right? It's like,
I had no idea. Yeah, like, but I mean, it was crazy. I mean, like these, and we would play like legitimate places. We weren't playing basements or house shows or anything. Like, we were playing bars with like meals and people there. And
you'd call
somewhere and they'd be like, "Well, we'll put you on the Shellac show or whatever." It was just like it was just the way it worked. It was really strange.
And because because your rent was $250 a month or whatever it was, it was not very hard to. Yeah, and gas was super cheap. It wasn't actually that hard to come back and have a month's rent and the month rent that you just paid for.
I literally got my driver's license the year that gas went above 89 cents, and I was like, oh, maybe to go back down. So anyway,
yeah. And all that driving you too.
Yeah, and all that. Well, you know, when I was younger ish.
So you never did the whole sleep on couch basement.
Okay. That's all we did.
Because
sleep
you just
on
made
couches.
It seem like. So you played the show.
Played the show. Then you would announce that for the last song, you'd say you had stuff for sale, and then you'd say, "Hey, if anyone has some extra space, we're 4 or 5 clean living guys, and we'd love a place to stay and come see us afterward." And most of the time, somebody would.
There was always somebody in every town who was like, "I'm the guy that lets bands sleep at his place.
Yeah,
come back to my house and watch this weird Sun Ra documentary with me, man."
I refer to that guy as the Sun Ra guy because he existed in many different
every
towns.
Single city.
No tour romance stories.
Yeah.
Have you heard the Pitch Plan records?
Yeah.
Yes.
It was like they were thinking about this. It's almost like we were trying to see how we could alienate anyone that could possibly listen to our band by making a collection of inside jokes and atonal songs.
Did any girl show?
It totally worked.
Any girl show up to the show?
No.
No.
If they came with their boyfriends, and they also dressed like dudes, so you couldn't tell they were women.
Yeah. Unless they had a zine to sell. Maybe they'd show up to sell their zine.
So let's fast forward through Pitch Plan. You guys,
hold on, wait. Do you have a Pitch Plan song?
I could play like a hit, a relative hit.
Let's hear a hit.
Here's a hit. We'll be right back.
Pitch Blend.
Oh, the 90s.
Pitch Blend with an E. So, wait, was that on 7-inch cassette?
That was on a CD and LP, actually.
Did it self-released or what label?
It was on Cargo Headhunter, which is like the same label drive that Jehu was on. Stuff like that. But the way we got signed is actually kind of a cool story that talks about the old days, too. Because we sent a cassette demo to CMJ magazine, which was actually really important at the time. And they put it on the cover as best new music. And then we got letters in the mail from record labels.
Yes.
With like major labels, Move Slowly.
Well, how long did that take?
Yeah.
The whole thing probably took maybe...
You had to have a P.O. box.
Probably six weeks, probably. Like the whole thing from when we sent it to when we saw it.
Yeah.
Yeah, about 6 weeks.
As opposed to like a band goes up on Stereogum and gets into a bidding war in like 24 hours.
Exactly.
Yeah, there was no bidding. There was no bidding war.
6 weeks is still pretty fast.
Well, it was all horseback then too. Yeah. So it's amazing.
And then you guys quit your jobs, right?
Yeah.
Well, the great thing about DC was after we kind of started going on tour, after the second tour, we never had like the same job. And DC is full of temp jobs, so we all worked for like the government. I believe Triops, our guitar player, had a job where he had to go to the Coke plant and shake six packs of Coke to see if they had leaks.
Bottles were broken or leaked. I worked at a drug testing lab reporting results. Yeah, everything was a gasp.
Yeah. And what were you eating at the time? Because
it's really funny.
You guys were svelte, to say the least.
I think about those times a lot because I don't seem to have very many food memories of Washington, D.C. It's mostly because we were broke, but I mean, we also lived in group houses, and I remember cooking a lot, but I remember lots of pizza. There was a place called Armand's that had a $5 all-you-can-eat pizza buffet, and we would go there. Deep dish.
Justin and I shared a house with some people for about a year, and occasionally we would cook together. We kind of grew up in a similar way, kind of Italian-American family, like Sunday sauce kind of thing, and we did that a couple times, but... It was DC, same here. I don't have a whole lot of memories other than going to Burrito Brothers occasionally.
Burrito Brothers.
Yes, getting that would be a big night.
4,000 calorie thing of rice and beans.
Any good tour food stops?
Yeah. Actually, but later when we ended up playing in Turing Machine too,
I'm Pitch Blend. Triops didn't really eat. Pat was a vegetarian who didn't like food, so he would just kind of go off on his own.
Triops has my favorite ordering thing, where we would be at like Ben's Chili and Cheesesteak Restaurant, and he would order the salmon. Like, he was that guy.
Right.
Like, no, I was like, don't.
Don't do
like,
your
salmon is terrible.
But, you know, there's a kind of a hierarchy where you're lucky if they buy you a pizza for the show. And then above that, you might get a buyout, like a $10 buyout.
Right.
So you'd get a $10 buyout, and you'd go kind of fan out around the neighborhood where the club was and see like what you could find. And generally, Pat, the vegetarian, would go off and buy a burrito. And Scott and I would actually
try to find a restaurant. And those little things, like, you know, when you're in a punk band and you're sleeping on floors, if you could just manage to scrape enough money to do something that you consider kind of civilized during the day and sit in a restaurant, have somebody bring you food and relax and be like, this is going to be okay. And sit there and talk about how nobody's probably going to come to the show or whatever. But it like give that little period of time where you're not as anxious.
We also, there are a handful of times where we'd be stuck somewhere. We were in Olympia, Washington for a long, like maybe 2 or 3 days. And we made like a Sunday sauce.
Yeah.
And that was great. It was fantastic.
Right. We would cook at people's houses and like cook for them. And that was always
just watch
fun.
Sunrod documentaries all day.
Exactly.
And cook Sunday sauces.
Exactly. And one of my favorite memories was in Livingston, Montana, outside of Bozeman or Missoula. I forget. Someone helped me with Montana. Anyway.
I think it was outside of Missoula. No, it was outside of
Bozeman. Which is great. We stayed with this guy, John, God, what is his last name? Anyway, he booked all the shows and you stayed in his house. He's actually now a big deal Hollywood sound designer, actually. But we stayed with him and he left, but he left us elk steaks in a marinade. And we had elk steaks
and we barbecued
whiskey
elk steaks outside.
Chili marinade, and that was just amazing.
I would eat that now.
Oh, yeah. it was
great.
Incredible.
So, like, that was sort of the trajectory Scott and I got on around that time, because we grew up in big food families and we were traveling. And, you know, around like the third or fourth or whatever tour, we'd been to a lot of these places before, and it kind of became about like, what else is there to do?
How
in
can
the
I
city?
Make this more interesting?
You end up seeing the Williamsburg, you know, of every single place you go to. If you're lucky, you play the Bedford Avenue of every city.
There's
which is great.
One.
Right. If you're unlucky, you're not paying the Ainsley
and it's in Virginia.
Yeah.
I remember
colonial and classic.
Darren when you came, when I lived on Capitol Hill in Seattle, and he's like, so where are we gonna go hang out? And I was like, I'm living where we hang out. And then we did that, and then it's like, that's it.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Exactly. Like, I was there for a weekend, and I was like, and by Sunday I went, well, I've seen it.
Yeah.
Cool, Seattle.
We have a very good Capitol Hill in Seattle food store. We were in Seattle for a couple of days, and we stayed with this guy, Niels Bernstein, who runs...
He was the publicist VP at Sub Pop then,
yeah.
And now he's the publicist.
And he always stayed with him, and we were there for a couple of days, and a friend of his had just been to Alaska, and I guess FedExed the salmon in or something.
Yeah, his friend was salmon fishing in Alaska, and FedExed him, overnighted him, like wild-caught, cold-water Pacific salmon.
Wow.
And they had this amazing salmon. Did you guys grill? I missed it because I went to go see a college friend, and that was not fun. But I missed the whole thing, and I missed
a Drew Barrymore show.
Drew Barrymore
back
show
in the day. Yes. Back around when she was dating the guy in Hole, and then we all went to a drag show.
Oh, yes, the drag show.
Wait, Drew Barrymore show?
No,
a drag show.
Drag show. Oh. So let's...
We're on your show. Pay attention.
Yeah. Oh, so, yeah. Darren heard wild-caught salmon. He's like, now I would get like some lemon. Yeah.
That's what we did. We steamed lemon in the oven.
Let's talk about the decline of Pitch Blend. When did you know that your time at the four-piece was over? What was the end game like?
We had a really miserable last tour where Justin and a couple other guys in the band got a ton of stuff stolen. And then about...
Which number tour was this?
Like three or four.
Four or five.
Was it like a one
night? We did weekend shows every weekend up and down the East Coast. So like we would be in Boston and Philly and...
And Richmond.
Richmond. Like we were always like around... And lots of college shows, but then we'd go on like full tours like once a year.
Yeah, this is one of those like 2 month tours, and we got a bunch of stuff ripped off in San Francisco, which is why I still can't love San Francisco. And then about
the food scene is like, don't judge us.
I know. And about 2.5 weeks later, we thought we had kind of recovered, and then I got the crap beat out of me in Albuquerque, and we had some more stuff stolen.
What?
And by then, we were just okay. It was just kind
of all of our clothes
just
got stolen silent after Scott got beaten up outside the band by like some like cholo dudes, hoping that they'd do a lot better than five luggages full of thrift store clothes and dickies.
But that's what they got.
Yeah. These skinny, nerdy dudes look like they got a lot of Louis Vuitton going on.
Yeah. Exactly. So we got back and,
You blamed it on the band?
No, I think we were just
kind of ready.
We're getting older. Like,
we were playing more and there were diminishing returns and... And it was like, we had traveled enough, too, to be like, wow, D.C. sucks.
Yeah.
Let's get out of D.C.
We're in this town, and it's midnight, and there are five or six different places where you can get food.
Right. Yeah. So the band breaks up, ends, and you guys look towards Brooklyn, New York?
I was thinking of Chicago or New York, and the woman I was dating at the time, girl, I guess, at the time. We were young. That's what I mean.
Didn't you say you were getting older? How old were you at this time?
24.
Oh, yeah,
getting older.
Yeah. We're getting older.
Yeah. So, and I was looking at Chicago, and she got a job here, and then I moved here. And it ended up being a great decision. I'm really glad I didn't move.
What year is this? I'd
probably be playing jazz. This is 94.
Okay.
And I moved a couple months later. I moved, actually, weirdly enough, March of 95 to the third stop on the L train, Graham Avenue, and...
What was that like?
There was my landlord who was the cop who'd been kind of done something and he got demoted to being a peace officer and made very unfunny racist jokes to me all the time. Told me how I could...
As opposed to the very funny.
Yes.
Very big distinction. Like, yes,
the Louis C.K. racist jokes that we've grown
to. Those are hilarious. He was not in that. Told me how I could get my car off the insurance rolls if I wanted to go out to New Jersey and that his son would help me. And there was the White Castle, and that was pretty much it.
I remember coming out to see Scott because I lived in Manhattan at the time. Because you could do that there.
Where'd you live?
I lived on 27th and 3rd in a neighborhood that my friends was so bland and so white, my friends referred to it as Little Pittsburgh.
whose mom lived in your building?
Yeah. Barry Manilow's mom lived in my building.
Has Murray Hill gotten much better?
I had a one bedroom with a doorman and a washer and dryer for $1,200 a month that was rent stabilized.
I would visit him and think that he lived in the Jefferson's
apartment. I looked at in Manhattan at the time, so it was a different era. But Scott lived out here, and I remember coming out, and I felt like I was going to the middle of nowhere. And now I work four stops past that.
So what jobs did you guys have at the time?
I got a temp job back then. There was just tons of jobs, and so I like got a temp job the first day I moved here, and they offered me a job that day that I temped, and so I ended up working for 5 years at a health insurance company doing like weird shit.
And Scott?
I didn't have a job. I was unemployed, and there was a moment where I'd $400 left, and just trying to figure out, well, I guess I can move back to Maine and live with my parents. Actually, they were divorced. Live with a parent. So I spent my days, my roommate and I, we figured out that people wouldn't give us any shit if we walked around like everyone else did in the neighborhood. So we walked around literally shirtless, wearing jeans, drinking Rolling Rock in our neighborhood for maybe a couple of weeks. And then I got a call from John Fine, a friend of mine, who was working in journalism, and he needed help on a project that eventually became Time Out New York, actually. And so I did that and thought I had it made because I had, I think they paid me like $100 a day, and it was like, it was all great.
Did you get tan?
I did. I got tan. It was good.
And so then where was the, it's like, hey, like we should do another project.
I was living in the same John Fine.
And what year is this?
1996.
John Fine of... which
John
band?
Fine of Bitch Magnet and Vineland and
Coptic Light.
Coptic Light, yes. Soon to be releasing a new memoir on the indie rock experience.
Yes.
Yes.
Where we both make cameos.
Yes, exactly. With cameo.
Hey, did shirts on?
Shirts on.
Did he make you look
shirts
cool?
Shirts off. No, it did not. Anyway, so John lived in a loft building on Roebling and South Second. Big building, I think.
And Roebling and South Second in 1995 was terrifying.
$1 a square foot. They had an 1,800 square foot space. They paid $1,800, and there were four of them. There's a studio in half of it, and I was in between places because I'd moved out of my my racist landlord's house and lived in the studio and kept my sleeping bag in the bass drum. And during that time, Justin started coming in to Brooklyn more often, and then the drummer of John's band, Vineland, we kind of got along with, and we liked the same kind of music, so we just started playing. And I don't know exactly know what happened, but at a certain point, we had a handful of songs.
Yeah, and we did this thing where we played. It was me, Scott, and Jerry Fuchs, and we did this thing where we played for 3 years, and we never played a show because we were convinced that we were going to get a singer because nobody wanted to hear an instrumental band. And so we went through like a handful of friends and strangers, and it always sucked. And then one day we were just like, "Oh, wait, I think we're a band. Like, I think we actually." Like, we can just do this. These songs are pretty sweet. Like, let's just be an instrumental band. And, I mean, we can't have less people like us than, like, Pitch Blend. So,
why don't we hear an early one?
And
what year was this?
This is 96.
96. I think one of the earliest songs we wrote on the first record. I will play. What should I play?
I don't know. Go for it.
Let's play a song called Got My Rock Pants On. How's that?
Thank you.
And it goes.
And it goes.
We didn't write a lot of short songs.
I mean,
sorry about that.
I have to say, for any of you fans, like, just dive into Spotify if you have it. Like, I spent this weekend listening to all of your records. Man. Well, my first memory.
Ka-ching.
Yeah. What are you getting on?
I think you get 0.01 cents.
Yeah. So you guys made money by coming on here, is what I'm trying to say.
Sure,
so
I'm not going back to work.
My first My first memory of you is that I did college radio, and I used to have the 8 a.m. Friday show. So I would, you know, go out drinking all night Thursday, and then, you know, like, go to bed for a couple hours, get up, go to the radio station, and on the days that just the hangover was more just like,
so
still
you did
dark.
Drive time.
8 a.m. drive time, Eugene, Oregon. I think that's like a lot of people on bikes. I would just try and find records that had like the longest possible song so I could play them and then sleep.
So we are the stranglehold of indie
rock.
Yeah,
so it was like the Live Built to Spill album, a couple like...
Oh, you just play Cortez the Killer?
Yeah, like Rodan records and then your guys' records. So I would put your guys' records on and just kind of like put my head down on the counter and that's
that happens
how
a lot, by the
that's
way. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the general reaction to our music.
New Toy Machine album. Thump.
But anyway, that was like the first, and I was like, oh, this band is great. Oh, and then I went to sleep.
And I first saw you guys at 4040 in Philadelphia.
Yeah.
R5 production show. And
shout out to Sean Agnew.
Sean Agnew walked by me afterwards and was like, wasn't that the sickest fucking thing you've ever seen?
So
and Sean was a big supporter.
And then all I went was, Sean Agnew just talked to me.
In my mind, just with Sean Agnew, he's only a few years older than us, but to us, because just the way that it works, Sean Agnew is like a giant in our mind and like could potentially, is like, because he started so young, even though did so much stuff for so young, he might as well be like 50 in my mind. He's been doing so much
stuff.
He's
incredible success for DIY too. And if anybody really has, inspiring dude. Yeah. And we cruise, we run the Coachella cruise together.
Yeah.
So.
So 96, the band is, you know,
we just started.
You just started. What's the
first
food?
Record kind of was recorded in 99, so it took us a little.
Okay. Yeah. So what's the food landscape for you guys at that time?
A lot of cheap food.
I think we weren't really making a ton of cash, but we were eating a lot of Chinatown.
I would walk in over the crumbling Williamsburg Bridge at that time, and we'd meet up and we'd get Vietnamese food a lot. We had a lot of pho. We called it pho back then. I guess now we have to say pho.
Now we sell pho.
And we literally would go to the same place. I was just saying before.
Was it pho Nutrang?
We would go to pho Pasteur.
Pho Pasteur. And pho New Pasteur.
Yeah, I went maybe 40 weekends out of 1 year.
40 times,
fairly certain. You go in, same guy working, no glimmer of recognition.
Yeah, I see the same people. I go to Pho Bang with my wife all the time, and same guy waits on us every single time for 10 years.
We know what they say about white people. Nothing. All the same.
That's true.
That's funny. And they just
order number 8. They all order number 8.
What was number 4?
It's the pho with brisket.
Can I get that with no tripe, please? Yeah. Thank you.
And now you're like, the more tripe, the merrier.
Back then, like, we'd go out to Queens to, like, you know, we heard that there's a Brazilian restaurant or whatever. It was all ethnic food because that was the cheapest way to eat, too. You'd go to Jackson Heights to eat Indian. You'd go. You spent a lot of time trying to find the rumor
of the barbecue place in Queens that had real barbecue. This is before barbecue blew up.
Was that at the Car Auto Park?
I don't know. We just drove. We went to a couple places, and one time it was closed. It was that sort of thing. Like, someone always had a car, and we would always
try to drive out to these places. You'd hear about a burger place. You'd go out to the burger place in the back of a sports bar or whatever. Like, it was always about cheap food. Like, the idea of dining... Like, the idea of eating in a restaurant in the 90s for us that had two numbers in the price of the food was out.
Yeah. Right.
Like, you know, if it was over $9.99, there was a place called Sotto Cinque on 3rd Avenue, which was pasta under 5.
Under 5.
And, like, we'd go there, you know, like... But we tried to find the best food we could for what we could afford. We were still really... For even being broke, we were incredibly picky.
Yes. Snobby, picky.
Isn't that what indie rock is?
Yes.
Of course, yes.
I'm broke, but I'm very picky. Oh, yeah. Is that the floor I'm sleeping on?
Is there a cat here?
Not this Sunrod documentary. I've seen this one.
Exactly. I get it. He's from outer space. I know.
So you guys start touring, right?
And you see,
that's the thing.
Turing Machine was never really
Turing
a touring
Machine was
touring
actually
band.
Ironically named because we never toured really more than I think we
and
did.
Everybody thought we were called
10 days.
Touring Machine, yes. And then we'd have to explain our way out of that.
So oh, yeah, that probably wasn't band. A nerdy conversation at all.
No,
it?
No, and it usually was with women. No, yes. It was not with women.
Yeah. So no. You didn't learn the lesson from Pitch Blend with an E. You're know, like, we'll call it Touring Machine,
and we won't have a singer.
Yeah, we won't have a singer.
Got it.
Well, at least you couldn't alienate women with
gold.
With what?
You couldn't alienate them, just
that's
math
true.
Rock.
That's true.
That's true. But, so things did change, but things have very much changed. I mean, at this point, we're playing, and the audiences are they're pretty 50-50.
50-50.
Well, because now you're playing with that sweet disco sound.
Exactly.
Yeah. Sweet disco sound, yes.
So 99 first record comes out. What's it? What label is it on?
J-Tree.
Love J-Tree.
And that was the...
That was
like the golden years of J-Tree.
99. Just like Brazil was on that record.
Our first show was with the Promise Ring. Like, they called us, and they were like... I knew those guys, and they're like, come on, stop playing in a practice space. Play a real show. So we went and played with them at some college
at
upstate.
Bard.
Yes. Oh, well, you had a good chance up there with Smith and all those, right?
Yes, I was expecting
a lot. You know, when you play with a Promise Ring, pretty much that's for all the attention from the girls.
That's true. I was expecting a lot of black turtlenecks and smoking, but apparently that hasn't been like that for a while.
Oh, man. But that part of, was it New Hampshire?
No.
That's upstate New York.
Upstate New York.
Tivoli. So... So we ended up playing with like all the Jets to Brazil, like we did a small amount of like regional touring with all those bands because they were friends. Joan of Arc.
We essentially, went out to Minnesota and back.
Yeah, and it was great. Yeah, and then we did that two times.
Yeah.
And what was the reason that kept you guys from being on the road?
We were all employed.
All employed. Yeah.
And we were all like, "There's no way I'm gonna like."
Jerry worked
broke
at the stock
again.
Market.
Jerry worked in the stock market for a while, and then like kind of bounced around and like ended up working at Scholastic for a long time. And we just, we really didn't ever want to compromise being employed, especially living in New York. It's scary, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
Still scary. So you were at Time Out, and then you were just...
I was never at Time Out. I ended up, that was a project that fell through, and I ended up weirdly helping start ESPN Magazine.
Okay.
Then after that, I went to work to VH1 and wrote TV specials for them.
What were some of your specials?
Oh, Where Are They Now is a big one that I wrote.
Which is kind of like what this show is about, but...
We're right here.
Yeah, exactly. That's not an insult.
Oh, right.
Okay. Is that an insult?
No.
Okay.
Not at all. What was your favorite Where Are They Now?
My favorite Where Are They Now was when we got the guys from the Vapors back together for the first time to talk, and they sat down in London, and they hadn't really spoken since the day they broke up, and they still hated each other, and they got in a big fight.
And you guys don't even know who the Vapors are, so that's the best part.
Turning Japanese.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
And now they make shows like that. They make shows where
now
they just,
make, exactly. We should, like, should have just made an entire show out of that genre instead.
They did. They made that
Bands Reunited.
Bands Reunited.
These guys were not... It was two of the guys that were super successful. One guy was a lawyer. One guy was like some other entrepreneur. And the other guys, you could tell, were just like, I can't believe you ruined my life by kicking me out of this band.
And we're going to get you all together for a big special on VH1.
Exactly.
So then kind of take us through the next few years. The first record comes out in 99. You're touring a little bit.
Playing here and there on the weekends.
We played a lot in New York. We played like, you know, we were selling out Brownies and stuff like that. And
played Brownies last show as a cover band, which was kind of fun.
What was the cover band?
The very, very last night of Brownies. Like, everybody that had ever played there got up on stage and did covers.
Ted Leo did a set. We did a set.
Radio 4 did stuff. And it was super fun. Like, sort of the house favorite bands.
Ted Leo, did he play for 3 hours?
No, but he did do Barbara O'Reilly.
And Mike Studo stage dove at the end of it, which was really epic.
That's true.
Yeah.
What did you play?
We
played a Minor Threat song with John Fine singing.
We did a Mission of Burma, song. We did a Killing Joke song.
Oh, yeah. And I think we did Me, I Disconnect From You by Gary Newman. And I think we did No
Joy
Love
Division
Lost
song.
By Joy Division. Because those were the only covers I know, so I know that's what we played. Exactly.
Yeah. I know five cover songs.
We used to actually, it's funny, with Turing Machine, up until, you know, maybe 2005 or so, we'd always end the show with a cover where we'd sing. Because we felt bad, we made people listen for 40 minutes of instrumental music. Yeah. So that was always kind of fun.
Apologetic.
It's like a really sad
cover. Sorry about
cover.
That.
Yeah. Sorry, guys. Here's
but during
a song
that
you
time,
know.
The late 90s or 2000s, Don Cab and a whole litany of other bands.
Those are bands that we played a lot with.
I went to a lot of Tristeza. Like, I would go see bands.
We played with them, too.
There was no lyrics.
Believe me, if there was a band that didn't have a singer, we got the call to play with them.
I mean, did you fully embrace math rock as a title, or did you?
I think we always wanted to play with bands that didn't sound like us.
Yeah, our whole thing is, like, we really always, and that's, it shows, like, the way we ended, made the final record, is we were really always trying to be sort of dance music-y. or dance music related, even though at that point I didn't listen to any dance music, but I had seen a lot of car commercials. So I figured it kind of had a general idea. Yeah. It's a general idea of what it was. But I mean, we really were sort of into that kind of concept. I mean, it was more like we want to do something more funky and groovy.
And you did that with Panthers, right?
Yes, exactly.
So, but let's do early 2000s.
Yeah. 2000s, we actually started writing some more songs, and then we recorded a second record called Zwei, which means, I believe, two
in German.
And recorded a record with Steve Revitt, who is a good friend of ours, who ran Front of House Sound for LCD Sound System and recorded a bunch of other bands that are bigger than us. And that came out on French Kiss Records.
Ooh, which what up, Sid?
Exciting. Hi, Sid. Have you found our masters yet? Because no one seems to be able to find them. No, it's true. They've gone missing. It's very Eddie and the Cruisers, if you saw that movie.
They're going to show up in a box in 20 years.
Yeah, exactly.
And you'll re-release your second album.
That sounds perfect. So we recorded that and then went on a little bit of a tour. Went down, did we do South by Southwest that year?
Because I was in Panthers then too. And so we did a double tour where like both bands were in the same van and I played both shows each night, which was actually really fun. And but the tour was whatever. We went South by Southwest and back, and we had a great time.
Yeah.
But
speaking of dance rock, that Panthers Thank Me Both Hands Mastercraft remix was one of the first like dance rock.
That thing was huge.
That came out, and that's when like you could actually collect all the dance rock songs, and it was like that,
like,
and the
House of Jealous Lovers,
like Phones, Block Party remix.
Yeah.
And I remember trying to find out like Mastercraft, who are these guys? And they had like, they just had like this weird photo up on their website, and like it was like really cryptic. And I was like, huh. And we played that at all of our dance nights.
Found out it was the dude from Death from Above 79.
We were just not that savvy at the internet. It took us a while, but that was like one of the first. So.
Well, you'll be happy to know that there's a Turing Machine remix Double 12 in the works.
That's true.
Which we're excited about.
Hot Chip remix, Steve Moore remix, House of House remix.
And a DJ McNanny remix.
And a DJ McNanny remix.
Wait, that sounds amazing.
Who's putting that out?
Temporary Residence. We're waiting on a longer version of the Hot Chip remix. So
long intros and outros for those DJs?
Exactly.
Totally.
So you look like you're ready to play another song.
I can play a song off the second record.
Yeah, hear a song off the second album. Then we'll
play a little bit, and then we'll go right to the...
We'll bring it to the future.
The new record, the future. Yeah. All right, here we go. This is a bit of a fade in. Oh, yeah, look at that.
Well, that changes everything, by the way. Thank you.
I can see where the funkiness is already creeping in.
Yeah.
So around this time, you
year is this? Now where are we?
I have no idea.
The record, the record came out in 2004.
So and you've toured, and yeah, Justin, you're getting into wine about this time, right?
Yeah. Someone we're all friends with, Jay Strell.
Love Jay Strell.
Jay Strell, the great connector.
When he actually lived in a group house with Scott and I in D.C., and he was really into beer. He was really into beer. And he had these Michael Jackson, the Beer Hunter videos that I would watch that blew my mind. Because I got into the whole idea that it was travel related. Not Michael Jackson. There was a white British Michael Jackson.
Don't you mean two white Michael Jacksons? Exactly.
So he had these, and I got into that idea and like that beer was like regionally specific. And it was, even though we could only afford Milwaukee's Best or whatever at the time.
But we would occasionally go to the Brickskeller, which had a like 30-page beer book.
And we'd get really excited because we all ordered a $5 beer. And then I moved to New York, and Jay ended up moving here later. And we would like spend the days walking around and hanging out because that's what you did then.
Shirts on or shirts off?
Shirts. Oh, we were shirts on.
Okay.
So, but Jay would always go to Astor Wines or wine shops, and sort of by hanging out with him, I was like, oh, I can actually afford wine. I didn't know it could be cheap. And around then, we were still broke and young, so we were drinking like $5 bottles of wine, but they were actually made by people. And then Jay ended up getting a job years later. He was thinking about opening a wine shop, actually, and just never really found the right space. And ended up working at Uva Wines, and when it was on North 5th Street in Williamsburg. And it was like, you should work here one day a week. And I kind of bluffed my way into the job and started working there and got really interested in wine.
And what year is this?
Was it 03?
Okay.
04, yeah, 04 maybe, yeah. 04. And yeah, probably 04. And then... Little by little, like a year and a half later, I really got so into it that I became the buyer there when the buyer left.
I remember you were telling me you were super excited about the Wine Avenger book.
There was a book by this guy Willie Gluckstern called The Wine Avenger that I got really into, and it was like it was about like don't ever spend more than $10 a bottle of wine, and they're swearing in it and all this shit, and I got really psyched on that. And so I used to go into the city then when I got really serious, and I'd go in the city and buy wine and bring it back to Brooklyn, and because there weren't wine shops out here, and I don't know. It was just
so. And how quickly did you become known as the wine guy of your friends?
A couple years, maybe. I don't know.
Quickly, yeah.
Jay was kind of the wine guy for a long time, and then I found sort of my niche, which was natural wines and stuff like that, which is sort of the indie rock world version of wine. So,
do you find that a lot of your indie rock tendencies just moved over to food?
I think it's not just indie rock, because all that little picky shit is just. There's music like that, there's food like that, there's clothes. I know people that are really into wine that are really into fashion or book collecting, too, that don't care about indie rock. It's just, like, they're all similar obsessions.
Doesn't care about indie rock?
I know, it's sad.
It's weird.
She sounds female.
And then, Scott, how did you make your way into...
From ESPN Magazine to...
It was the culmination of essentially 15 years of... doing a lot of freelance food writing for some awesome publications and some less awesome publications. I essentially needed money and knew a guy who edited the Farmer's Guide to New York. Remember those when they came out every year, big mm-hmm. bound books?
Yeah.
And I edited the dining restaurant section for 2 years, even though I had just moved to New York and didn't know anywhere to go. And that was...
You're like, I heard there's a barbecue place out in Queens.
No, it was a lot of phone calls to Le Cirque, asking them to send me menus and tell me about their specials. And then I'd write up a 30-word blurb about it, and then...
Sparrow's. If you're looking for New York's best pizza.
Sparrow's was not in there. We tended to keep the chain restaurants out, but there were three levels of expense. And we never really had money to send me anywhere. And then I wrote a few things for a Time Out where my now actually boss, editor-in-chief Adam Rappaport, was the food guy back for Time Out. And I wrote one piece that he really liked, which was essentially living in New York on $5 a day food-wise, which is all about cooking out all your meals, eating leftovers. It was a week. I fudged it a teeny bit, but not that much. And
what was the fudging?
I didn't actually eat the chicken salad the next day from the roast chicken and a lot of that kind of stuff.
Okay.
Oh, you could have.
You could have.
You could have.
I see that you've been holding that guilt for years.
I did feel
kind of
bad. We
didn't even probe you, and you're like, I got to come clean.
And then he went to GQ, and I wrote a piece for him where I went upstate and killed a chicken. This is pre-everyone
with his bare hands.
Everyone killing things.
Snap the neck or the knife to the neck.
No, it was actually an axe, which I since found out is less efficient, and you should actually just cut the vein and bleed them out. Which is actually much more brutal. I've done that too. That's not fun. But the axe is just, yeah. Anyway, so I did that, and I was always doing freelance food stuff on the side, and then eventually got back in touch with Adam when he got this job and sent him way too many memos, and I think he just gave up and said, all right, please, enough of the memos, come on board.
And what year is that?
That was when they moved Bon App from L.A. to New York. They essentially got rid of the entire staff and restaffed up in New York, and so that was 2011, January.
So Turing Machine second record came out when?
2004.
So what happened in the interim between? I mean, obviously you guys got jobs and everything. Greg.
Well, I mean.
I mean, can we not talk?
A lot happened. Yeah.
I mean, of course.
Well, yeah, at this point, our drummer Jerry was playing a lot of other bands. He was in Chick Chick Chick. He filled in and
played the Massive Attack record.
Like, he was doing a lot.
He was really becoming the guy.
A real drummer. A real musician. Like,
unlike us, he was like a guy who would have been a professional musician for his life.
Yeah. And, you know, and so we didn't play a whole lot. We would kind of get together and play a bit and get some steam, momentum, and then he'd go away again. So in 2008, we went upstate?
That sounds right.
Yeah, we went up. I've just kind of falling down house upstate. So we went up there for a long weekend of food and essentially recording a bunch of demos.
And our friend DJ came up. Our friend Mike came up. And we just like cooked and drank and played.
I mean, we went through
nonstop.
How many cases of wine did we
play? We did like 3 cases in 2 days.
Amateur. Amateur hour.
We essentially played and drank all weekend and came away with a lot of really good stuff. And then listened to it, got excited about it. Then it kind of sat because Jerry went away and played.
And we tried to replay it and it never had the same vibe because they were all improvs.
Yeah.
And we couldn't really relearn it. And then we never really had the momentum.
And then we started playing a bit, and we had a couple of really good practices. And then, you know, and then about a year and a half later, as you may or may not know, people listening, our drummer died in a horrible, horrible accident. And obviously the band was put on hold, and it bummed everybody out, as well as you might imagine it would when one of your best friends passes away. I had to bring the Rita show down. So
this is, I mean, I only bring it up because it is part of your guys.
Yeah, of course. But you know, we got talking and we thought, what the hell? Let's see if we can finish this record. And
a lot of our friends were like, come on, you guys, like, you have all this stuff recorded. Don't pussy out on this. Like,
oh, hold on, I heard a really great story. Wasn't there a story about?
I'd like to hear the story.
He was still listening to the CDs.
One of the gruesome things that happens when a friend dies is if you're an adult, you know, your friends come in and you clean out his room and call the family. And we were cleaning things up, and in his CD player was the CD of the demos. So he'd been listening to the demos, which is great.
And the last time we hung out, we were really talking about, like, dude, let's just finish this. So we ended up going back. We had very generous friends. Our friend Jeremy at Temporary Residence, our friend Andrew Raposo, and then our future, soon-to-be friend, Abe Seaforth. They really got with us, and they were like, let's finish this record.
There's a lot of stuff here. You guys can do it.
Yeah,
Justin and I didn't know.
It's
a new way of making records for us. It was
We didn't really know how to make records on the computer and edit and all that stuff. We just used to go in and play live and make it. But there was enough there that we really were able to edit it and make it into a record. And it was...
The records...
I still think it's the best thing we ever did.
It's amazing. So. And I just want to say that when we got it to... I mean, I'd never seen you guys growing up because no one ever came to Eugene.
Right.
It's
true.
Yeah. Okay, Pitchblende.
There's a way to make gas money on the way to San Francisco.
Pretty much. Or, you know, south of Portland. But when I saw you guys play at Union Pool, I was like, holy shit, these guys are fucking amazing. And like when you played that Union Pool show, which is still one of my favorite venues to see bands.
So we ended up playing some shows for fun. We got our friend Chris Egan to play drums, who's now on tour probably for the rest of his life with Solange Knowles.
Yeah. So you guys are really gifted at finding gifted drummers.
Yeah.
Yeah. Finding drummers who we work well personality wise. And Chris, yeah, so Chris was a perfect fit.
That was another thing, another reason.
And where did you happen to find Chris?
He worked at the wine shop with me.
At one point, we were rehearsing for our first show with a new band because we added 2 people after this record, and 3 of the 5 people in the band actually worked at UVA.
I remember when you guys played.
It was really hard to practice because we had to figure out a time where everybody couldn't be at work.
Right. It's like you guys, I think there was one show you played where like UVA just shut down for the afternoon because it was just.
He had to run back to work after a show outside. Yeah. But so that's fun. And we do that more for like events and party shit, yeah. You know, like
yeah. Should I play a song?
Yeah, let's play a song. No, because we'll
no,
go
no,
out.
Let's finish up. Yeah, we'll finish up.
We'll finish,
up.
We'll finish okay. out with it. So, so what's on the future for you guys, both food and musically?
I'm really into the wine importing thing right now, and just got back from 3 weeks in France. We signed somewhere between 7 and 9 new producers.
This new band has got some hot stuff coming out of
Champagne. Yeah, exactly. So that's been great. And
I mean, is that what it's like, though, when you're signing a new wine
little, guy? It's a little like that, but it's not. But bands like are somebody that's existed for a year. Like I'm talking about people that have made things for a long period of time that like work, you know, farmers. Like being in a band is easy. Being a farmer is no joke.
Can you just give us a quick rundown of what it's like to find a new wine and sign them?
It depends. It's mostly personality. Like you go, you taste, you hang out. Hopefully it's good. A lot of the time it's not. You find something you really want, and then you have a conversation about who else you work with. It is sort of, you know, in a label way, it is that kind of thing where, like, once you mention people that they respect that you work with, then they trust you. But, you know, a couple of American dudes just rolling up to some farmer's house, you know, to taste and hang out, they can be suspicious until you show who your references are. And then you taste, you hang out, you go to the vines, you spend time together, you eat together, you develop a real relationship, and then when they trust you, they put a bunch of wine in a truck and it shows up in New York, you know, and we sell it to restaurants and shops.
And what's your favorite new wine?
I don't really have a favorite.
You love them all.
No, I just what do you I really like. I like our book and I like our portfolio, and I'm really excited about what we're doing overall. And I think it's really amazing to see it all as one big package.
I'll ask another way. My parents, their wedding anniversary, mm-hmm. 34 years. What type of bottle would you recommend from your book for them for 34 years?
I don't know. I don't know your parents. I'd have to know what they drank, you know? I mean, that's the thing. It's
so
like, it's
democratic.
It's about the time and the place. It's not like a cachet thing where like, oh, this will, you know, this is going to make you happy. I think, you know, we have things that I think are really epic and beautiful, but
although you didn't know, that is actually the correct answer. Well done. And if people want to find out where to get your wine, where could they go?
Well, we're working on a website. We don't have one. So we will have a website in the next, I'd say, month. We'll have a real website up. It'll just be ZevroVineSelections.com. I think it's ZevroVineSelections.com or ZRSWines.com. I can't remember.
Say that one more, a little. How do you spell that?
ZRSWines.com, okay. Or it's ZevroVineSelections.com. That's my friend Zev's name. He had the company long before we started working together. And I've helped him sort of develop a lot of the stuff he's done the last few years, and we're having a blast.
Awesome. Scott, what do you got coming up?
I actually got a little bit of traveling coming up, which is good because normally I am desk bound. I'm going to, where am I going? I'm going to Maine for a little story. I should be going to London. Quickly, London, we get asked to play Altamara's Parties.
Oh, yeah.
We went on a food tour.
And essentially, Justin and I just set it up with our friend Nancy. The show was the smallest part of it. Oh, the show was fantastic, but we set up food all around it. We did a DJ night the day after the show in London so we could actually spend an extra day eating. We ate with the dudes from the Young Turks, Isaac and
shout out,
and Daniel,
so
and Johnny. We ate upstairs at 10 Bells, and they served us the menu they were working on for the new restaurant, Shoreditch Clove Club,
getting
which
really
just
good
opened
reviews.
Up.
Oh, it was so awesome. That was one of the best meals I had
really
last
fun.
Year.
And so that was, we had a really great food experience in London. But where else am I going? Oh, I'm excited about Mexico City. Mesoamerica. That should be a blast. I've never been. I have a good friend of mine who goes like once every 6 weeks, so I'm excited about that.
That's awesome. I think the last Swallow issue, Swallow magazine, was all about Mexico City. It's a scratch and sniff, so you should check it out. So
I don't know if I want to check that out, really.
And then Turing Machine?
We're looking for our first show in 2013.
It's hard to get. Yeah. I mean, there are 5 grown men, and three of the other guys have very, very serious musical things they do, and so it's really hard to get us in a room.
Yeah.
We're hoping to do something interesting in the end of June, early July.
Oh, my God. That'd be a great name for your next album, 5 Grown Men in a Room. But we'll talk.
Interesting, you know, Googling that.
Yeah.
Wait a minute.
Well, we'll figure it out. Maybe we'll get you guys to DJ the barbecue series again this summer.
Oh, we did that last year. That was a good time.
Was a lot of fun.
We'll do that with Garrett and May and something like that.
Great.
Well, I want to thank everybody here at Heritage, Jack, Aaron, Patrick, Joe, all the interns.
Rec Tech.
Rec Tech.
All the people eating in front of us.
All the people thinking
behind the window.
The people at Roberta's. Mom, Dad, Joe.
Happy anniversary.
Happy anniversary.
150 episodes.
Greg.
150. Congratulations on 150 episodes.
Pretty awesome.
That's some real stick-to-itiveness. Really, I could never do something like
that. That's why I was kicked out of Gifted and Talented when I was a kid, because I didn't have stick-to-itiveness.
Yeah. You didn't get a... You got a wink and not a smiley face.
Essentially, yeah.
Awesome. And, you know, hopefully in a year we'll be doing 200. And this summer we got a lot of good things. What's the smirk?
No, I'm just thinking about next
week's show. Oh my God, you're
going
to quit already, aren't you?
Yeah, no, so all this has really been great, my last show. No. And, you know, thanks to my job for letting me to come.
Thanks to all of our jobs for letting us come. And if you've missed any of the 150 episodes, which I can't imagine why you would have, they're all up for the archive on heritageradionetwork.org. Please become a member. Support us. We are at the mercy of membership drives.
It's true.
It's true.
I have one more song to play. Should I play the one with vocals or the one that's kind of a krautrocky jam?
Which one do you think best represents the future of Turing Machine?
Play the krautrocky jam. The other one takes forever to get.
Krautrocky jam. Here we go. Thanks a lot for having us.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks.
Thanks
a lot, guys.
Thanks.
All right.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.